We're going to listen back to an interview with actress Lynn Redgrave. She died Sunday of cancer at the age of 67. She was part of the famous British acting family that included her father, Michael Redgrave, her sister, Vanessa, and Vanessa's daughter, Natasha Richardson, who died after an accident in March 2009. Lynn Redgrave first became known in the U.S. for her role in the 1963 film Georgie Girl. More recently, she was in the films Shine and Gods and Monsters. She also did theater and TV and wrote and performed a series of one-woman shows based on her family history. I spoke with her in 1986.
The character you played in Georgie Girl was a little chubby, a little overweight, wanted to really be beautiful, but certainly didn't think of herself.
Not at all.
That way, yeah. Did you worry that that would give you the screen persona of being someone who was unhappy with themselves and, you know, couldn't make it as a beauty? Because let's face it, in movies, people like to see beauties, right? And did you think it would narrow your chances for playing leading roles later on?
Well, at the time that I made it, no, I didn't think that at all, because it was a wonderful break. I was at that time with the National Theatre of Great Britain with Olivier and was playing some wonderful parts there. That was really how I envisioned my life. So doing a movie was a wonderful experience, but not something that I thought I was going to make a career of in any way. Nor have I, because I've always mixed up the mediums enormously. But at the time that I made it, she was another person to be. It wasn't until I saw it that I realized that that's how people saw me, and that's probably how they saw me anyway, quite apart from the character. And it wasn't until the movie was a success, which nobody at the time knew it would be in the way that it was, that I then did find the double-edged sword of great success in a particular role, because, of course, all the next few parts I was offered would be, you know, she ambled down the street on her heavy hips wheeling a baby carriage. You know, those would be the opening statements, and I would scream with horror, and not because I didn't love playing Georgie Girl, but because I've always felt that if I played somebody once, why would I play them twice? I see no purpose to that. I also think that is very limiting, you know.
What were your first big breaks that got you established? And did you find that having the name of Redgrave helped you or hurt you?
Well, the name of Redgrave did both, really, to begin with. In England, unlike America, nepotism is a really dirty word. If somebody knows you because of your parents, they probably in England won't even see you. They'll say, oh, you know, Michael's daughter, I can't see, you know, preferential treatment here, better not. I mean, I tried for ages to get an audition for a certain theatre company who absolutely wouldn't see me. I'm not even talking about give me the job, but just see me, purely on the basis that they didn't want to play favourites. Well, I was applying like anybody else. I had a right to be seen. Those things go against you. Certainly they did in England. I think the advantages are that they'll look at you. You know, the thing that actors cry out for is just give me that chance, just give me that moment to be noticed. If you have a famous name, they're going to watch and they're going to listen. Now, that is a double-edged sword. When you're starting out, they expect you to be either brilliant or they may expect you to be terrible because, well, obviously it won't be any good because they're just there because they're the kid, you know. But either way, you're expected, you're in some way, there is an expectation put upon you as a beginning actor that has no right to be there. So you're in the spotlight, which is good because they're going to notice you. But if you're less than brilliant, they're going to remember. So you're not going to be able to come back next time. I mean, I've got friends who talk about their early audition days and they did a terrible audition for somebody and 6 months later they went with trepidation for another audition for the same director. My goodness, they'll remember that I was terrible last time. The director didn't remember them and this time they got the job. Well, if your name's Redgrave, they remember you. And that's great if you're any good. And it's just, you know, but it does put you in a spotlight that maybe you shouldn't be in when you're just starting, you know.
You must have developed an incredible sense of speech growing up in your family because your parents were both great actors and they'd both done Shakespeare, right? And you have to just know about speaking and you usually have a very nice voice if you're involved in that pursuit. Were you very aware of voice when you were growing up?
Well, very much so, yes. First of all, while I was growing up, my father was incessantly on at us about our speech. Just in every day, for example, putting an extra R where there isn't one, I saw it sitting on the table. He said, you what? You saw it. You didn't saw it. There's no R there. He would pick us up. I mean, and we hated that. But, of course, we listened, you know, because his dad, you know. And we, at that point, nothing to do with acting, just that he hated poor speech. He hated poor grammar. So one had that all around one. As to good speech, of course, because he was a Shakespearean actor and a classical actor, and my mother too, they both knew, as only stage and classically trained actors know, that you can't just happen upon a good voice. You may have some things about your voice that are more melodic than somebody else's naturally, or pitched a little better, but that you still have to train, and you've got to train a lot. Now, I used to have a very, very high, thin voice, and I have trained and continue to train. I would never go on the stage without warming up my voice vocally.
What did your voice used to sound like?
I'm not sure if I could do it, but it was pitched very. It was pitched high, and it was back here, and it was very sort of like that.
What did you do to deepen it?
Well, first of all, I did train for 3 years in drama school and British drama schools, and I can't speak for American drama schools because I haven't been to one. British ones certainly spend an enormous amount of time every day on vocal dexterity, on diction, but more specifically on breathing. All of good voice comes from really initially from how you breathe and how you support the voice in the same way that a singer does. It's just that most people speaking don't think that's necessary. They can get by without, but you can't get by on the stage. And what you can't really do is have any flexibility of your voice. If you want to play somebody who doesn't talk like you, then why would one just stick with what you've got? I mean, I know plenty of actors who do and avidly say, you know, this is the way I talk, and tough. And I just think that's stupid. I think that's limiting. You know, you should be able to do anything. In theory, your voice should be able to do whatever you tell it to. And sometimes for certain parts or certain roles, you're going to have to train all over again at any age in order to get that dimension and not hurt your voice. Otherwise, you can't play 8 performances.
Do you think of yourself as being good at doing dialects and getting other people's voices?
I am. I have a natural ear for dialects, for accents, for mimicry in a way. And that's just luck, I suppose. That's, you know, some people have to work a lot harder at getting an accent. I recently did a movie. I've played quite a few parts where I've had to, in my terms, have an American accent. In your terms, lose my English accent. And because everybody knows I'm English, of course, it's especially important that I be totally specific, because everybody's listening to hear, oh, well, she doesn't really sound. She really sounds English, you know. So you have to kind of make them suspend disbelief by getting it even more perfect.
Throughout your career, while you've been married and since you've been a mother, and you were saying you have 3 children,
yes.
You've, I think, tried to really not sacrifice the family part of your life for your career. What have some of the things been that you've done to make sure that you're able to keep that balance?
Well, I like all my children to know what I do and understand where I do it. So they have always come and seen me backstage of where I work, if it's a theatre. I think it's first as little children, it helps them a lot to just that you have to go out in the evening to know where it is you're going and have an idea that it's something very practical. You have to sit down, you have to fix your wig, you have to put on your makeup, that there are a whole bunch of tasks, that there's a certain discipline in the theatre. I've had all of the children backstage with me at various times. Annabelle last year, when I was doing Aren't We All on Broadway, she was not quite 4 when the first time that I brought her to a matinee. I used to take her to all the matinees, and she helped me. She helped me with my shoe changes, because, you know, obviously she would, at not quite 4, she couldn't do the zip, but she couldn't reach. But I gave her a job, and I also took her all around the theatre and showed her why she had to be so quiet, why there were certain rules. And I've done that with all the children. The older children used to tour with me. We used to pack up school books, and off we'd go on the road, all of us.
Lynn Redgrave, recorded in 1986. She died of cancer Sunday at the age of 67. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.